coming to you from a jet bound for Morocco, it's The Liberal Arts.
A podcast about post-grad life and the things we would study if people were paying us.
Please, somebody pay us.
I'm Science.
I'm Cleo.
And I'm Rissa.
Alright, great to see you all. And by see, I mean here. Yeah. And by here, I mean hang with y'all on Audacity. Hey guys, did you know that one of the first people to suggest the chemical equation for nuclear fusion used the prize money that he got for suggesting it to bribe some Nazis?
What?
To do what?
You're gonna have to start that over. What?
Yeah, okay, he used his prize money to do what now?
Okay, Hans Bethe. It might be Bethe. It might be Bethe, I don't know. I don't speak German. Hans Bethe, 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 Bethe.
Hans B.
Hans.
Hans was one of the first nuclear physicists to suggest a chemical equation for nuclear fusion, which is the chemical process that happens in stars.
Hold on, when you say suggest, was it like the correct one, or was it like the first guess?
Yeah, he was pretty much the first one to get it right.
To get it right, okay, cool.
Yeah, it was a mystery for a long time, but that is what, he was one of the first people to figure it out.
So, to suggest a correct equation.
Yes. I'm guessing if you just put some vinegar and some baking soda and some starlight, maybe it'll go boom.
Boom.
And that's how stars work.
And no one knows why.
So, he took that paper, wherein he suggested the correct equation for nuclear fusion, and he entered it into a contest that was being held by the New York Academy of Sciences. They were offering $500 for a good paper about stellar energy. He won the prize, and then he took the prize, and he used it to bribe some Nazis.
Ooh, what bribe for? Them into doing what?
So, his mom was trying to emigrate from from Germany to the U.S. after Kristallnacht. He was Jewish.
Mm.
And so, she made it. But all of her stuff was trapped in Germany, and you had to pay a fee and also a bribe in order to get that stuff from Germany to the United States. So he heard about his mom's dilemma. He withdrew the paper from the journal he'd sent it to and sent it to the New York Academy of Sciences instead. He won the prize, and then he used that prize money to get all of his mom's stuff to the United States.
Nice. Wait, yeah. Did you just completely pass over the point of the first man to successfully suggest this equation was Jewish?
Yeah, yeah, I did pass that over. He was Jewish. Hans Beth Bath Butha.
B. Hans
brother,
B.
Stop.
Good old Hans. he actually said that he felt more at home in the United States than he ever had in Germany. He said it's almost as if he found his home country when he turned 28 when he moved here.
Aww.
Yeah. So that's been a fun fact.
That is a fun fact. I like it.
You filled the fun fact quota.
Alright. So, friends.
Yes.
This is highly anticipated. but I am so glad to introduce Rissa with today's colloquium. And Rissa, would you tell us what today's colloquium is about?
I will. Yeah, so you guys know that my main interests are video games, philosophy, theology, history, and art. And I've chosen a topic that somehow combines all of those.
Yay.
So this is going to be
the
start of a pretty long series that will go eventually into art and video games, but it's going to start with a lot of history and a lot of theology mixed in. It's about one of my favorite people of all time ever. Saint Joan of Arc.
Ooh.
I know, I'm very excited. I'm looking at the calendar now. I have been working on this for over 6 weeks, and it just keeps getting longer and longer and longer. So the longer I try to write this, the longer the series will be.
Turkey.
We better Quick, act fast.
Turkey is gonna be, like, completely out of existence long before Joan.
Yeah, right? No, so I'm planning this to be at least, I think, a three or four session talk about this story of St. Joan of Arc, and then after that, talk about kind of her influences on art and some of my theological thoughts on art depicting saints and things like that.
Ooh,
yeah. But so first, before we start, there's something we need to talk about.
What's that?
This is something, Cleo, you're going to know a lot more about this than me because you've kind of more formally studied the study of history. But we need to talk about biases.
Ooh,
now
I love
this
talking about biases.
I know. This is going to come up in, I mean, a lot of our studies in history, but it's going to have to really be addressed at the start of this one. I have at least three specific biases that I want to kind of announce beforehand. I'm not saying I'm putting these down. I'm not actually trying to be unbiased. I'm trying to just let you know what my biases are.
Frankly, I feel like we'd all be in a better position if more people did that.
Yeah. So that's what I'm going to try for, especially because the more books I've read about Joan, the more biases have become apparent to me. And I think mine is very different from most of the history books. So, the first bias is more of a problem for the podcast, and it's this. I am not French, if you couldn't tell, and I cannot speak French. I'm very, very sorry, but I am probably going to absolutely butcher the pronunciation of every single proper noun in this entire story. I tried looking most of these up. I am from Texas.
That's not a country.
I was really hoping you would say Texas.
So I tried looking most of these up, and by looking up, I mean Google Translate made it read the word out loud in French. But I'm very bad at this. So please excuse all of that pronunciation. The second is much more of a serious thing, and that's the bias that I am, and we are all three, Christian. And this probably won't come up in every topic of history, but it is going to come up here because I'm going to talk about theology and the history of someone who was Christian and was in the church. So,
and who's canonized for that.
Yeah, and who's a saint. Yeah, I'll just say that one. The third one I was going to mention is that though I am Christian, I am not a Roman Catholic. I've never really been part of a tradition that reveres and venerates saints. I don't know how much that will affect the discussion, but just since we are talking about a saint, someone who has been canonized, if there is more of a proper way to refer to her, I don't really know how to use it. So I think a lot of the time biases play out in who we listen to and what we allow to count as reliable. And so in these history books, the reason I'm bringing this up as my bias is because it's the opposite bias I see in most of these books. Most of these books, it seems, will believe any testimony about Joan except her own. They don't believe her. And, I mean, to be honest, if they're not Christians, that makes sense, because to believe her, you would have to believe in God, because she makes claims about God, and if God didn't exist, then you'd just have to say, well, those cannot be right, she must be mistaken. Some of them, not many of them paint her as a liar, most of them paint her as either maybe mistaken in that she might actually have a mental thing, or maybe she really did believe, but it was kind of just a dream, almost. One of the people who portrays her that I'm going to talk about much later, George Bernard Shaw, depicted her as a genius who just really didn't know that it was her own creativity that was making stuff up. And so she thought she was hearing it from outside. But all in all, I believe Joan a lot more than most of the historians I've encountered. I don't know all the details, but I am much, much more ready to believe Joan than anyone else about Joan's story. But yeah, so I just wanted to get that out there, that I might seem like I'm taking too much of her side on a lot of things. So just, you might expect that. I really, really like this woman and her story, and I believe her, which is not normal.
It's really interesting. Like, I haven't thought about whether or not... I guess I don't know enough about Joan, but I guess that's why we're here.
Yeah. So today we're actually going to talk about a good bit of the theology stuff. Today, I don't expect to get super far. We might get so far as Joan's famous meeting with the Dauphin, but we probably won't get to the Siege of Orléans. I've kind of designed this as kind of Joan's spirituality, Joan's military campaign, and then Joan's trial and death as a kind of a three-part history series. But we'll see how it goes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you say that word again, the person that she meets with?
The Dauphin?
So it's not pronounced Dauphin.
It's not pronounced Dauphin.
I'm so glad we
clarified
that. I'm
not sure I'm doing it perfectly, but it is not Dauphin.
Okay, it's good to know.
Dauphin is what I've been taught.
That's how I've always pronounced it in my head.
It is not pronounced like
Dolphin.
It is not pronounced like Dolphin.
Or Duffy.
It's French and theological somehow.
Yeah, I've heard that as well. Whenever I watched Kenneth Branagh's Henry V, the Dauphin is in that, and he says it, and I'm like, is that the word Dolphin? What is this? Who is the French Dolphin? Okay, so Dauphin is just, it means crown prince.
I'm sorry. It is I, the French Dolphin.
Well, they have Disneyland Paris. Why not Disneyland Paris? SeaWorld Paris.
SeaWorld Paris.
SeaWorld Paris.
It means crown prince.
Oh, okay.
Yes, it means crown prince. So the person who is to be king but is not yet crowned king is the Dauphin. Like I said, I really do have, like, a 6,000 or 7,000 word biography drawn up from, like, 7 or 8 different sources.
That's terrifying.
So the first thing I wanted to point out is just, it is truly remarkable how much we do know about Joan. Like, it is astounding. Some people have called Joan the most studied figure in history, and of one whom we have the most record. And most of this is because Joan was tried, like, put on trial at least 2 or 3 times during her life, and 1 time after. And we have the record from 3 of these trials, and they are detailed. Like, they really pried into every aspect of this woman's life. I mean, for real, we have all of these records. She did not live to see 21. And we know so much about her. So if I say something, especially something detailed, and you're like, wait, how would we know that? I want you to ask, because I'm trying really hard to not make up any of these details as far as I can.
Okay.
But let's start with Joan of Arc's name. Despite the anglicized Joan of Arc, Joan was not actually from a plain place called Arc. She was born in Domremy, France, which is now called Domremy-la-Pucelle after her, and she was born around 1412.
What was the last word in
La
the
Pucelle?
Name of the place?
That comes from a title she'll adopt. It means the maid.
Hmm.
And we'll get to that name in a bit. But first I want to talk about this Joan of Arc name. And let's see. So she's not Joan of Arc. She is D'Arc. D'Arc is her father's surname. I'm not sure she ever used this surname. And she also didn't use the word Joan. So Joan is an anglicized version of the name. Joan is the English version, female version of the word John. And her name is the French female version of the name John, which was Jean or Jeanette. She spells this J-E-H-A-N-N-E when she signed letters.
Good job, Joan.
Yeah.
That's so many letters.
Well, it's the medieval French version. We now spell it the same, but cut out the H. So J-E-A-N-N-E is how the French would spell her name. Jeanne d'Arc. But she didn't really use this name either very much. She mostly went by this title, La Pucelle, or the Maid, and this title was either self-appointed or given to her really early on by the soldiers, probably in Robert de Villerecourt's court, but we'll get to that when we get here. I want to look more at Joan's childhood. So Domremy was a small farming area loyal to the French crown, surrounded by the Burgundians, and this... Well, I guess brings me to my first point. We're going to have to back up a little bit to set the stage for where Joan entered into history. Joan was born during...
By the way,
yes,
Burgundian is a funny word.
Isn't it? Burgundian really is... So Burgundians are those who follow the Duke of Burgundy, which was an area. Okay. So she was born during the Hundred Years' War, which... as it sounds, was a very long war fought between the kingdoms of France and England.
How long did it last?
100 years.
Really?
That's
shocking. Can't make this stuff up. So her story comes near the end of the war. When Joan was 3 years old, the English king, Henry V, won the famous Battle of Agincourt, which Shakespeare writes about in his play Henry V. Not entirely accurately, but he does.
Well, you know, it's Shakespeare.
And just like isn't Shakespeare, after this, King Henry married Catherine. So Catherine was the daughter of the current French king, Charles VI, Mad Charles VI, he was called. And the promise was made that Henry and Catherine's heirs would inherit both the English and French thrones, uniting the kingdoms, after Charles and Henry died.
Wow, though, that would be like, okay, no, wait. Yes. France and England being one kingdom, that would change so much history.
Yes.
Like,
well, this is the problem.
Why didn't that happen?
It didn't happen because Charles VI had another son, Charles VII. And that Charles, like, in order to create this union between Catherine and Henry with this promise that Catherine's sons would become king, Charles's mother, that is the Mad Charles's wife, had to disinherit her own son and claim that he was illegitimate in order to appease the English.
Ooh,
so why Henry VI didn't take the French throne was that when Joan was about 10 years old, Henry V and Charles VI, the current kings of France and England, both died. And by their promise, Henry and Catherine's son, Henry VI, should take the throne of England and France. The problem was, the kid was 9 months old.
Ah.
Yeah. They couldn't really crown him yet. And so, in this time...
That'd be too big.
Catherine's brother, Charles, who had been labeled illegitimate, claimed that he wasn't illegitimate, that he should sit on the throne of France, and proclaimed himself the Dauphin, the Crown Prince of France. So that should kind of help set the scene. Finally, the Burgundians, those who follow the Duke of Burgundy, were a group of militants who controlled most of what is now North and Eastern France. They were allies of the French throne. They were allies against the French with the English. So they used to be loyal to the French throne, but when the English kind of had their own heir, they supported Henry's right to the throne and not Charles's.
Okay, so Joan is born in a place where she's surrounded by people who think that France and England should be one kingdom.
Yes, she is surrounded by people who support Henry's claim to the throne, the Burgundians, because they support the Duke who has made a deal with the English. But I think her actual village doesn't, but it's surrounded by lands that do.
Okay.
Yes. So that's kind of setting the scene there. You got Henry and Charles both think that they're going to be king. Neither has actually been formally crowned yet or anointed. That's really important.
Okay, so this is pre-Protestantism, so they got to get, like, the blessing of the Pope, right?
Yes. So in France, I was going to talk about this later, but in France, it is tradition that the king be crowned at Reims Cathedral. This is the cathedral Charlemagne was crowned at, and therefore every king ought to be crowned at Reims Cathedral by, I guess, the bishop if the pope isn't present. That's really important, and neither of them have done that yet. At this point, Reims, by the way, is in kind of northeastern France. It is in English territory at the moment. Most of northern and east, well, most of France, to be honest, is in English hands. And the French have been pushed back and pushed back and keep losing everything. And everyone knows that the Dauphin doesn't have any money. He's broke. Really, really broke. In fact, the English have also taken Paris and kicked him out. He's fled to a place called Chillon. And some of the people loyal to Charles from the University of Paris have come with him. So they don't have the capital, they don't have one of the biggest cities, and... We'll get to some of that later. First, I really do want to focus on Joan this time, and we'll talk about her military career later. Because I don't know how much she knew about politics at the time. She probably knew some of this, but she didn't know all the details. Joan was born in a little farming village, and her parents were farmers. And to be honest, it really is astonishing that we know so much about Joan's childhood. Like, I can not only tell you her parents' names, but her siblings' names, her uncle's name, her godparents' names, the names of her childhood friends, her vicar, the people she confessed to. Like, we have a ton of first-hand accounts, interviews of people who Joan grew up with, other people who lived in Domremy. We know that she spent a lot of time in church, that she confessed often and by all accounts gladly. We know that she learned household skills like spinning wool and sewing, that she helped herd sheep and plow and harvest. We know that the children of her town often danced and held picnics near a certain tree in a certain well, and sometimes Joan joined them. But we know that she didn't often dance with them. We know a lot about this woman's childhood because of the trials that she was put through. And I'll get to those kind of near the end of this history lesson. But when Joan was 7, when she was 9 again, her town was attacked by Burgundian forces and free-roaming mercenaries. Both of these were a really big problem throughout the Hundred Years' War. So we also know that she had at least seen some kind of conflict and probably helped her town flee. And by helped flee, I mean helped herd all the sheep so that they didn't get stolen.
Gotcha.
So she had seen some level of conflict, and it helped run away. This is interesting. We don't actually know that Joan took a vow of chastity. Chastity was very important to her, especially after taking that title I talked about, the maid. Mm-hmm. Because maid inherently involves, one, you're young, and two, you're a virgin. Those are two things that maid means. We do know that Joan says she had sworn to keep her chastity until it pleased God she should marry. And to some people who didn't like Joan, this was almost worse, because Joan had taken neither a vow of marriage nor a vow of chastity, which were the only two ways that most respectable women could live.
You can't have both. You got it. Married or not.
They wanted her either married or like in a nunnery somewhere. They didn't want her doing anything else. One story we do know is that at some point before she was 17, Joan fought and won a court case against a man who claimed she had been promised to him in marriage. And the reason I mention this is because this is surprisingly common for female saints. There are several saints who have stories where someone insists that a man, usually a rich man, insists that they marry him, and they flee to escape this.
That is common.
That's actually pretty common. But I want to get to the interesting bits about Joan's life. So when Joan was 12 or 13, she began to receive visions and hear voices, or a voice. She said that she heard the voice for the first time around noon in her father's garden, and that it was accompanied by a light. And Joan was understandably frightened by this, but after the third time, she said she knew the voice was from God. She would later associate this voice with the Archangel Michael and say that she saw him, as well as Gabriel on occasions, and very often the saints St. Catherine and St. Margaret.
Oh.
And I want to stop here and talk about this for a second. One thing I want to make really clear that you don't often see clear in the history books, Joan did not go around telling everyone that she heard from the Archangel Michael or from the saints. I want to make that really clear. She claimed she heard from God. That was really important. All that mattered to her was that these messages were from God. And especially in her younger life, that is all she says about them, really. It's very late does she ever mention the angels and saints, especially the angels. Like, in her trial, they asked so many questions about these visions, and she, for the most part, refused to answer. She said that she had not been given leave by her voices to talk about them, really. Mm. And so, I don't know, there's some question as to whether the saints and the angels and the voices are all the same thing or different things or what really happened there. But what matters is that Joan heard from God.
Wow. Why would she... Okay, no, you said she wasn't given permission.
Yeah, she said she wasn't given permission to, and that she said she would go and ask, can I tell them? And once she was given permission, then she would. But that's all way later in the trial. Right now I want to talk about these saints and what they said to her and things like that. So the first voice, eventually she will recognize as the Archangel Michael. And Michael, one of the things Michael tells her is, don't be afraid, and also that these two other people, Catherine and Margaret, will come to talk with you as well. And I want to stop and talk about these characters for a second. One of the reasons some people think Joan may have been making up some of her stuff was that the saints and angels she refers to fit her story, like, too perfectly. You know what okay. I mean? And now, to me, this could mean that, I mean, God sent the appropriate messengers. But it is very convenient, some of these.
Okay.
So, like, Michael, the archangel. Michael, the archangel, had recently been recognized as the patron saint of the French royal family, which obviously became very important to Joan. Gabriel is the angel who most often delivers God's messages in the Bible. And then St. Catherine and Margaret's stories reflect Joan's own a lot. Like, really briefly, I'm going to tell their stories. So, St. Catherine of Alexandria was a Christian in ancient Rome when the church was heavily persecuted. And when she became a Christian, she went to the emperor and reproached him for his cruelty to the Christians. And the emperor basically made her...
told off the emperor. Yeah. I love her.
Well, the famous story of Catherine is when the emperor made her enter into this huge debate where he pitched hundreds of scholars and learned men against this woman in debate. And she schooled them all. And, I know, it's amazing. but this image of all of these learned men versus this one woman alone kind of comes up later in Joan's trial. Eventually, she angered them by defeating them, and the emperor says that basically he'll let her off if she'll marry him. And she says, no, definitely not. No. And so Catherine is murdered. She's most associated with the wheel, as in, the torture device, because of this.
Oh.
Yeah. And then St. Margaret, the other, known as Margaret the Virgin, shares a fewer things in common with Joan, but she was identified as a shepherdess, for starters, which Joan was also. She also was tortured and killed after refusing to abandon Christianity and refusing to marry a man. There's also this really fun story in which St. Margaret was swallowed by a dragon, which was the devil, and escapes when the cross she was wearing agitates the dragon's stomach and makes it spit her back out.
Oh my.
So that's fun.
As you do.
I know. But anyway, so these are the saints and angels which Joan very late in life associates, and it could be that she associated them the whole time, but she doesn't go around saying that. And someone has pointed out that Joan doesn't seem to pay any, special homage to them. She doesn't go out of her way to say, visit the Church of St. Catherine or St. Margaret or pray to Michael. She doesn't really do that. Yeah.
I didn't know that angels could be saints.
Yeah. Am I saying St. Michael? I mean... Michael the Archangel. So the Blessed St. Michael is something. The Blessed Michael, that kind of thing.
Okay.
If I'm saying the angels are saints, I am mistaken. I am talking incorrectly.
So sainted rather than saint.
Yeah. The Blessed Michael, the Archangel.
Okay.
And then Saint Catherine, Saint Margaret. Sorry if I'm probably messing up all of this. There are very formal terms for how to refer to each of these people.
Okay.
So the only people that Joan shows special devotion to throughout her life is the name Jesus and Mary. She has some further connection to Catherine, which we'll go into a little later. Basically, Catherine, one of the kind of miracles surrounding Joan is the sword she gets that she finds upon, like, the saint basically tells her, you will find a hidden sword here in the Church of St. Catherine, and then she does. But okay. Really, that's the only other connection. So, like I said, I am more of the opinion that what was most important to Joan was that these voices were from God. And one interesting thing I've noticed through the records is that most of the time that Catherine and Margaret talk to Joan, it's not so much a form of instruction, like this first message she gets is, but actually more of a form of comfort. They come to her when she's injured, when she's imprisoned, and comfort her. And she asks them questions, and sometimes they answer, and occasionally they even reproach her and do bring messages. But a lot of the time, it's not the same as this big, big kind of message she gets at the very beginning. So this message she gets at the beginning, the voice that she hears when she's, like I said, 12 or 13, first it tells her a few things. First, it tells her to be good and to go to church. Pretty good advice, and she follows it. But as she grows up, this voice tells her a couple more things, until eventually it's telling her, like, two or three times a week that she must go to France. That is the part of France still royal to the royal line, and that she must go to the Dauphin. It tells her that she is to raid the seas of Orléans, and that she should start at Vaucouleurs. This is wow. Big.
Yeah, that's crazy.
A voice from God has told a farm girl that she is to raise the siege of Orléans.
Like,
yeah.
Like, okay. What do you even do? Like, what do you even
well,
do?
Well, we don't actually know what she did for the first few years. We don't know if she told anyone, or what. We don't have too much record of what she did in between this 12 and 13 and then about 16. We do know there's one funny little story, and by funny I mean weird, in which at one point it said that her father feared that she would run away with the soldiers and told her brothers that he would rather drown her himself or have one of them do it than have her run away with the soldiers. We don't really know if he was serious or how Joan was. Like I said, a lot of people, I think, make the mistake of thinking that her father was wanting her to not go lead an army. But, I mean, let's be real. When a young girl, quote, runs off with the soldiers, this usually doesn't mean to lead them. No. Usually this means to become a camp follower, aka a prostitute, who traveled yeah. where the army did. And I don't know that this is what her dad was afraid of, and obviously he shouldn't have worried about it. But, yeah, so we do know that Joan expressed some want to go with the soldiers. And I think, you know, obviously this was because she knew she should go to the Dauphin, but her dad may have misinterpreted this a bit.
Yeah.
Just a little.
And just kind of an odd story yeah. from her childhood. But in any case, at the age of 16, Joan asked one of her uncles to take her to Vaucouleurs. Vaucouleurs was a commune about 12 miles north that housed a garrison loyal to the French. So it was... It was the kind of nearest military outpost loyal to Charles. And here's what
Why
I mean.
Why does her uncle do that?
Well, okay, so one of the reasons her uncle takes her and why her father lets her go is because she actually travels with him. So her uncle lives closer to Vaucouleurs, and she travels with him under a couple pretenses. One is she's going to help his wife, who is going to give birth. And she's going to help with this process. And she does that. She's not, like, lying. It's just that while she's there, she asks her uncle to take her to see Robert de Beaurecourt, who is the captain of this garrison. And here's what I mean about details that we know. She wore a red dress. We know that. Like, it's not even important, but we know it. We have a lot of firsthand accounts that say she wore a dress that was red. We also know she had long, dark hair at this point. So, by the way, anytime you see Joan and she's, like, blonde or a redhead, just... She probably wasn't.
Wrong.
Yeah. Anyway, so, Vaucouleurs, Joan meets with Robert de Beaurecourt, who is a minor French nobleman, but he's in charge of the garrison. And remember, Joan is a 16-year-old shepherd girl. and goes immediately to him and asks that he escort her to Chillon to meet the Dauphin, so that she may raise the siege of Orléans.
Well then.
Oh my gosh.
So, guess what Robert says?
No.
Well, Robert's initial response was to tell Joan's uncle that you need to take this little girl home to her father and have her, like, give her a good beating until she gets her mind back. Like, lock her up, just take her away.
Yikes.
Needless to say, her uncle doesn't do this.
And Joan... But, like, why wouldn't he? Like, if he did, it wouldn't be right.
Yeah.
But it would be understandable.
It would make sense.
Yeah. Yeah, so he doesn't do this. And I don't know how much Joan told him. Maybe Joan told him everything. Maybe he believed her. But Joan did spend as much time as she could at Vaucouleurs for the next 7 months. She went back and forth a few times to her own house, and she had at least 3 meetings with Robert and gained the support of several of her soldiers, and this was important. She actually formed lasting friendships with several of the soldiers under Beaurecourt who supported her and wanted to take her to Chillon if only Robert would let them.
That's fascinating to me too. Like, how do you convince?
Yeah. So here, share one of the stories there. It's really fun. Jean de Metz was one of the first friends she makes in the garrison. And remember, she's like 16. Yes. He eventually helped escort her to Chillon. When they first meet, he asks her, "What are you doing here? And don't you know that the English will soon drive us all out? Like, basically, aren't you afraid? Why are you here in the garrison?" And her answer is just great. It really shows her character and her conviction and her purpose here. It's kind of long, but I want to. This is a direct quote from as much as I can from one of the records. She says, "I have come here to the royal chamber to speak with Robert de Beaurecourt to ask him to escort me or have me escorted to the king, but he pays no attention to me or to what I will say. But all the same, by mid-Lent, I must be with the king, even if I have to wear my legs down to the knees. For there is no one on earth, be he king or duke or the king of Scotland's daughter or anyone else, who can restore the kingdom of France, and he will have no help except through me. Although I would much prefer to stay with my poor mother and spin, for this is not my station. But I must go, and I must do it, for my lord wishes me to perform this deed."
Whoa.
That's what she tells Jean de Metz. And he asks her, "Who is your lord?" And she says, "The King of Heaven."
Oh, wow.
And as a note, the bit about Scotland's daughter. So during the Hundred Years' War, Scotland frequently allied with France against England, because it's England. and there were some talks that the Dauphin's son, Louis XI, ought to marry the King of Scotland's daughter to cement an alliance. I think they were eventually married. But after Joan died. But it was kind of what some people were, like, looking to. Well, maybe there's hope if only this could work. And she's here saying, that's not going to work. I'm what's going to save this place. And part of that may have been, this is interesting. So one of the first things that helps convince Robert de Beaurecourt is a prophecy. Not given by Joan, a prophecy by someone else, that had come about whenever Catherine was married off to Henry and his promise was made. So there was a prophecy that just as a woman, that is Catherine's mother, the queen mother, who had disinherited her son Charles, just as a woman had ruined France, basically, so a woman, a virgin, would save France. And so Joan obviously said, "I'm it. I'm her. I have come. I was prophesied." And this convinced a lot of people, to be honest.
Oh, this is very young adult novel-y.
I know, right?
But it already has more female characters than most novels. I know, right?
Yeah. But so prophecy is really interesting. Oh, sorry.
It is young adult. I mean.
Yeah, it is. Literally. She's 16. No, but prophecy is really interesting. This was not the only prophecy that helped convince Robert de Beaurecourt. Like, he took a lot of convincing, to be honest. Joan also made a prophecy of her own. And by most accounts, this was kind of the final act which convinced Robert to send her to Chillon. And that's when Joan correctly predicted the very unlikely French defeat at the Battle of the Battle of the Herring, before she could possibly have had news of it. So basically, this battle happened the same day, actually, and before the riders had arrived in Vaucouleurs to tell them what happened, Joan had already predicted the outcome. The Battle of a Herring is a fun little story. So at this time, and remember, Joan is claiming, "I will raise the siege of Orléans." She does not mean raise a siege against Orléans. The city of Orléans is currently under siege, and she will get rid of the siege. So Orléans was kind of a last hold for the French, but it had been besieged by English for, like, a really long time. I don't remember how long. But the Battle of the Herring was a battle that took part during the siege. So as they were besieged, the French attempted to cut off English supply lines. They sent 3,000 or 4,000 men on horses to attack a wagon train carrying pickled herring. When the English saw them coming, they circled the wagons and fortified. And the French initially attacked with artillery, which was pretty new, and they didn't use it very well. So they sent in the cavalry, which they were much more comfortable with, which means they had to stop firing the artillery. In the end, the English archers were able to use their wagons as cover and platforms, and they took out the cavalry, a lot like they'd done at Agincourt. The French retreated, and the English attacked their rear guard. The French lost around 400 men, and one of their leaders, Jean de Dunois, the Bastard of Orléans, was wounded.
Jeez.
So a really terrible attack, where a ton of French people attacked a few English people, and they lost. And Joan, predicted that would happen before they heard about it, basically.
English longbows, dude.
I know, right? But eventually, all of this combined between Jean de Metz's support, the other soldiers' support, the prophecy about Joan, the prophecy Joan made, eventually Robert was convinced enough to let a few of his men go with her, saying, "Go and come what may." They bought her a horse. It was black. We know that. I don't know why, but we do. And then, so Joan traveled with a group of soldiers about 60 miles, it took them 11 days, through enemy territory to Chillon, riding mostly at night for fear of the Burgundians. Most of the record we have of this journey is actually Joan's record of where she heard mass along the way. Usually had to sneak into enemy-held towns to hear mass, but she was very determined to do so. I think they heard it at least twice along those 11 days.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and she tried to get the soldiers to go with her, but I think they were pretty scared. So this is interesting. These soldiers around her seem pretty scared, this whole thing. And it's for this trip, very importantly, that Joan first cut her hair short around the ears, it said. I don't know exactly what that means or how short that means, but she cut it short and in the style of a man. And she put on the suit of a man at arms, which was donated her. Yeah, probably bull cut. it was donated her by the people of Vaucouleurs, probably kind of piece by piece, depending on what fit her. So dressing a woman as a man like this seems to actually have been pretty standard practice for a trip like this. She was
through enemy territory.
Yeah, through enemy territory. So she's being escorted through enemy territory by a group of men. And so they dress her as a man for safety in case of enemy resistance, especially if they're captured, so that everyone thinks she's just another soldier. And also because she's having to share sleeping quarters with the men. Because her clothing becomes so important later, I'm going to describe it a bit. So under her armor, which it was mostly like plate mail, man-at-arms isn't like a full, what you might think of as like a jousting armor. It's not that. That's kind of later. Or not later, at least richer. But it is like plate mail, like full plate mail armor. And chain mail underneath that and like padded stuff underneath that. So even under this clothing is fastened by a lot of ties. And it said that the tunic, the trousers, and even the boots can actually be tied together into one piece. In other words, it's going to be really difficult to remove, especially removing by force, and provides so much more protection than a dress. So much. And of course, it disguised her in case they were captured. And so I'm giving you all those reasons for cross-dressing because it's one of the main charges brought against Joan later. But from this record, it seems pretty standard. Like, even when she talks to John DeMetz, he looks since, like, in those clothes. as if you'd never get across enemy lines in what you're wearing in this red dress. And she's like, I mean, I would rather have armor.
That's interesting, because you think that a man-at-arms would draw more attention.
Well, I mean, when you're traveling with a group of other men-at-arms, it just kind of made her look just like the rest of them.
But the fact that you're all dressed as men-at-arms and trying to sneak across enemy territory is just kind of, hi, we're soldiers, nothing to see here, moving on.
Well, that's the thing. Everyone else seems actually really frightened. They insist that they travel by night. They're very scared, and Joan is the one who tells them, don't be afraid. God has commanded me to do this. It's gonna work, basically.
So did she sneak into church wearing the armor?
Yes, and that was actually one of the major things the church didn't like, is that she heard mass in the garb of man.
How dare!
I know, it was an issue for them. She also makes sure that everyone knows that she wasn't scared of the men she was with, even though she's sleeping next to them. And this is actually kind of interesting. Something, I won't call it miraculous, but some of the accounts do paint it as a little bit miraculous, that the soldiers who travel with her, different soldiers at different times, but starting with this trip, seem to kind of be in awe of Joan and how much it outshines her being a woman to them. Like, the people who slept next to her claim to have never had any carnal feelings or desires towards Joan at all. They can't even imagine how they could possibly think that way, because they are just in awe of her. They can't think of her in that way, in that carnal way. And most of them seem to be surprised at this fact, like, of themselves.
Weird that she was right there.
And I don't know, maybe this is after the fact, they want to make it look good, but I mean, she did travel with an army as a woman, and nothing like that ever happened. There's no stories of anyone attempting that while she was in the army, or anything inappropriate like that. In fact, most of the time, it's more like if, say, she wasn't there, and they were kind of joking about not so nice things to joke about, and she showed up, they would, like, stop.
Oh, gosh.
I'll talk about some of her effect on the army once she's really in it. But right now, this is just a quick 11-day journey that went without incident, which was surprising, because they were spending 11 days in Burgundian territory, and they didn't really meet anybody. There are a couple stories of, like, the Burgundians planned an ambush, but then they saw Joan, and then they didn't attack because magic, but most of those are pretty, you know, few and far between. Basically, they didn't really meet any resistance on the way to Chillon. At this point, Joan is about 17 years old, and she's come to meet the Dauphin, the Crown Prince. And there's a lot of stories about her meeting him, and there's a lot of stuff that goes into that. So I probably should stop here. I know we haven't really gotten to some of the exciting bit about her military campaign and all that. But, yeah, I just wanted to spend this first session talking about where she comes from, and especially about these visions. I think they're really interesting, and a lot of people kind of dismiss them as if Joan was just a patriot or just standing up for women's rights. I don't think she was. I mean, I think she was a patriot, and I think she did stand up for women's rights in her own way, especially refusing to get married at a time like this, and saying that, you know, she could do it. She, you know, could put on trousers and do this thing. But Joan was commissioned, and she really saw herself that way. She really thought that the only reason she was doing this was because the King of Heaven had commanded her to do it. And people believed her.
Wow. Do you think that I'd rather stay home with my mother and spin was the 14th century equivalent of I'd rather stay home and watch Netflix?
I think maybe. I think Joan actually was pretty witty in her trial, so I've always wondered if this was a big tongue-in-cheek, like, oh, I mean, I'd rather stay, but... You know what I mean? Maybe it was, I'd rather stay home and watch Netflix. That'd be pretty funny. I think it also may have just been like, I mean, I should be, quote-quote, at home, but, you know, kind of tongue-in-cheek. That's the thing. It's okay, Cleo, back me up on this. It's really hard to tell when historical people are being funny. Like, sarcasm doesn't come across very well. Like, I'm reading a court trial case, like, a court record, and it's very hard to tell when someone is being sarcastic.
Sometimes it is a really fine line between, am I just a sarcastic person and reading this sarcastically because it could be really funny, or are they being dead serious? It's frustrating. Yes. But it does make late nights reading fun.
So, yeah. There's an introduction to Joan and her childhood and her name and the history of the Hundred Years' War and all that.
I was Googling while you were talking because I wanted to know...
Please ask me the question. Maybe I can answer it.
Well, it's not so much a question. It's just I wanted to know what was going on. I have a timeline of the Duchy? How do you say it?
Yeah.
The Duchy.
It's not Dookie.
I'm sorry. I know that's...
It's Duchy.
Okay, thank you. You can edit that out if you need to. Hey!
I'm gonna post.
Hey! This is the person who named our last episode Poop Trail to the Pacific, so why...
Listen, you all said I should, so...
We should find a name for this episode.
Honestly, if we don't come up with a better one, I kind of like the title for this one, I Believe Her.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's the thing. I remember anytime I interact with someone who has done anything related to Joan, I'm always tempted to just straight up ask them, do you believe her?
I think that's a great question.
It is a good question. I think...
Because I don't think anyone else does. And when I've talked to my Protestant friends about... I don't really have enough Catholic friends to ask. But when I've talked to even my Protestant friends, I'm like, oh, well, I believe her. And they're like, I'm sorry, you believe her that saints talk to her? And I'm like, well, I mean, I don't know the details, but I certainly believe that God talked to her through something or some way.
Yeah.
And I really think that even within a Christian community, that's rather odd. And, well, okay, so here's one problem with it. And the thing that always gets me to be like, oof, but am I right? It's very dangerous to take a point of view in which you believe someone was from God because they won.
Right.
Like, it's very, very, very dangerous to say, well, they succeeded, so obviously God was behind it. And actually, so that's one of the things, and I'm going to get to this a bit later, but one of the things that shocked the English so much was throughout the Hundred Years' War, the English were the ones that were like, God is on our side, God is on our side, God is fighting for us. Like, when they won the Battle of Agincourt, it was very much God's sign that the English were correct. And so suddenly, for this woman to come up and say that God has damned the English... and God will restore the French. It's like, excuse me? It's a real problem. So she's definitely not the only one claiming to be from God. And what I don't want to do is say, well, I believe her because she was right, because she won. I believe Joan because I can see it in her person that this was real.
Because she believed it herself. And it's obvious.
Yeah. And it led to her death. And just through her reactions and the way she talks about it, I believe her because of that.
By your fruit, they shall know you.
Yeah, as Shaw would later write, there's something about the girl. It's a personal thing. It's not just because she won. And I mean, the fact is, she didn't win everything. Spoiler alert, she does raise the Siege of Orléans, but she doesn't raise the Siege of Paris. And then she gets killed way before the war ends. So, I mean, she succeeds in a lot of things. And I think all the things that were originally promised to her in her father's garden. Mm-hmm. But not everything she tries to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Interesting.
And, spoilers, she gets burnt at the stake before she's 21. Before she's 20.
I am really looking forward to the rest of this series.
I am, too. The fact that, like, she was 19 when she died just makes me very sad, because I am 23, and I have not done anything with my life.
You know what that sounds like?
What?
That sounds like a segue.
Oh, yeah.
To post-grad problems?
Post-grad problems. Oh, Cleo, do you have a post-grad problem for us?
I do. It's more of a whining thing. Basically, okay. I'm just gonna whine.
That's mostly what this is anyway,
and that's basically so. What this whole section is. Let's be real.
It's not necessarily a post-grad problem. People deal with this before graduation as well, but I'm dealing with it more acutely after graduation, and that's just filling out all the financial government forms that are apparently a requirement for adult existence. And
oh, like taxes and WPs
taxes.
And stuff.
I like went round about getting all my tax stuff together and finally got it done. So that's done and I'm happy. But healthcare, dude, this healthcare vote has really been throwing me off because I just switched jobs and the job I'm working at now doesn't have benefits. And so one of the things
you need to like. Go and buy insurance and crap.
Yeah,
or move to Britain. I mean, I was gonna say, because I have done significantly less paperwork in the last 2 years, but it's because I did the entire visa application process beforehand.
Yeah.
So basically all the paperwork just got front-loaded, and then you just don't have to do it for a while. But I'm also not actively employed. If I was, I would have to do, I don't know what kind of crazy tax work the British people have to do. But yeah,
so trying to figure out, and I actually had to hold off even looking until Thursday because I wanted to see what was going to go down with the whole revision
of
Obamacare.
Okay.
Because
do you want to know something terrible?
What?
No.
I have no idea what's going on with this healthcare. I have not.
Right now, the thing you need to know is that stuff's not going on.
Yeah. Nothing
okay.
is happening.
I mean, that's
basically
good question mark?
They tried to do a thing, and then they were like, oops, we can't do the thing. And then everyone was, like, secretly happy about it.
Except, so it was very confusing because I didn't know if this goes through, is there still going to be a healthcare mandate? Am I still required to purchase healthcare? Can I maybe put it off? And so it's been very inconvenient the last few weeks, and I'm sure it's been much more convenient for a lot more people. Has for me, but it's just been annoying. So,
yeah, this whole paperwork thing, I have no clue how that goes.
It's just like, what do you even need? What kind of documents do you even look for? I don't know.
What do you bring places when you go?
And then doing my taxes, I ended up paying someone to do my taxes this year because.
Oh, you don't have to do that.
Because of the healthcare.
Right.
Because I've worked at three different places in the last year with my internship and then the summer job and then with the school job, so I had to get together all my proofs of insurance, and one of them didn't come in until 2 days before my tax appointment. And so I couldn't remember how long my insurance had covered me in that job.
Right.
And so there was this whole... Am I going to get fined for not having insurance for so many months? Or am I going to be within the grace period? I don't know. Fortunately, I was, but...
Oh, gosh.
I just do not understand the concept of fining people for not having health insurance.
I don't...
Like, I'm no government person, but that just makes so little sense. You know that bit in Ever After when she quotes... what is it she quotes? She quotes...
Utopia.
You first make criminals and then punish them.
Yeah.
That is my thought on healthcare right now.
Yeah, it's frustrating. Like, car insurance I can understand a little bit. I mean, much more, because
I guess. But cars have... are... it's hard for me to say cars are a choice, because they're kind of not when you live in Texas. But life is definitely not. I mean, and we want to be really philosophical and, like, canary about this whole thing. Life is not a
choice. Yeah, that's true.
But...
So,
I don't know. Insurance it's has... very hard to kill someone else with your own cancer.
Yeah. And so...
I'm sorry?
It's like, okay, you can kill someone with a car pretty easily, but it's hard to kill someone with your own cancer.
Right.
So, like, I there's dissonance there.
Yeah.
I'm with, I don't know.
I'm totally for coming up with a solution to get as many people covered as possible, because it sucks to have something really catastrophic happen and not have any help at all. But...
I listened to this podcast the other day that's about medical history, and they did a whole podcast.
Is it Sawbones?
It's Sawbones!
Yay!
Oh, it's so good.
That's
I think
terrifying.
Okay, no, wait, this is a thing. Okay, so there is a movement going on right now among makers of podcasts, which, hey guys, we are those.
Hey!
Yay!
Called Tripod, and we might honestly be too late by the time this is uploaded,
yeah.
But... if we can recommend some podcasts, then we can join this little movement thing. And if you like, if you try the podcast that we recommend, then you should, like, tweet about it or put it on Facebook or something.
Yeah, tweet
with
at
the
those
hashtag
people.
Tripod. That's T-R-Y pod.
That's so fun.
That's T-R-Y-P-O-D.
Yeah.
That's pod.
Pod is one letter.
Pod.
What is this?
Elemental
letter pod.
Pod.
Oh, do we have to just pick... Do we have to just pick one podcast? Can we pick, like, one each?
I'll recommend Sawbones.
Okay.
It is a medical history podcast, which I find a lot of enjoyment about. Their tagline is, "Don't drill a hole in your head." They talk about all of the weird medical practices human beings have done throughout history. It's delightful. It's just absolutely delightful. And now you.
Schmanners is likewise delightful. Schmanners is a podcast about etiquette and the history of etiquette. It's just really nice to listen to, and they do a lot of research about, like, what is the etiquette behind dating and behind being a house guest, and then they also give advice, like, if you're a house guest, how should you behave, or things like that. It's really helpful. It's just really sweet listening to these two. Their tagline is extraordinary etiquette for ordinary occasions. It's very nice. So definitely check that one out.
All right, Cleo, what's yours?
Mine is The History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps. And it's
nice.
Professor Peter Adamson at King's College in London. And he literally starts at the pre-Socratics. And I think he's on episode 200 or something now, which I'm not anywhere close to being on.
Gracious.
200.
Because he goes through all of philosophy, and then he gets... into these different regions of philosophy. So he'll do medieval Islamic philosophy and then medieval Catholic philosophy. And
wow.
Just.
That's cool.
And he has all these different guest speakers come on. And so for his pre-Socratics, he had this woman, and I forget her name, but she came on as a guest, and she's like this expert in Heraclitus and has actually officially edited Heraclitus or something.
Oh, I thought you were gonna say, like, she met Heraclitus.
She did.
Like, Hannah, you see here.
She's secretly a Time Lord, and she met Heraclitus.
Yeah.
Everyone thinks the edits were done in this century, but they weren't.
Love it.
Wow, that was fun. I like promoting all that good content.
Oh yeah. Hey, listeners, if you try our podcast and you like them, you should tell us at our email address, which is theliberalarts@gmail.com.
We've got a Facebook group up. You can message us there. You can tweet at us. I think, I'm not sure if the Twitter is working. You can try tweeting at us. I think Facebook is probably the most reliable. We're still working out a lot of these kinks.
Oh, yeah.
We also have a website in which you can just leave a comment on one of the posts. Yeah, if you like this, if you don't like this, if you have comments, questions, if you want to correct all of my French pronunciation and everything else that I've said, which is clearly incorrect. Hannah, didn't you say we had someone contact us about the last episode?
Oh, yes, we did. So my friend Jesse texted me while he was listening to the episode. If you remember, I said something about how Benjamin Rush would blow up gunpowder in the streets to increase oxygen, mm-hmm. and how that didn't actually increase oxygen because that's not how combustion reactions work.
Did it?
Well, that's the thing, is he's like, some combustion reactions work that way, and I'm like, okay, but not the gunpowder one. And then I come to work the next morning, and on my desk is a peer-reviewed journal article about combustion reactions. And he's like, okay, fine, maybe gunpowder does it, but these ones do.
Love it.
Which tells you a lot about the sort of person Jesse
is. I was really hoping you were going to say you came into work and he had a barrel of gunpowder and was going to prove it to you.
No, 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 no.
He's like, get in the lab right now.
He also told me about an interesting thing. So I also said, if you remember, that mercury, they mine it as a side product of, like, other mining operations. Mm-hmm. That is not the case.
Oh.
It turns out that mostly they do actually mine for mercury. And the thing that they look for is cinnabar, which is decidedly less delicious than it sounds.
That, yeah, it sounds very nice.
Cinnabar is mercury sulfide. It's a mineral. It's kind of orangey red. And they look for cinnabar, and they basically take that and grind it and smash it up and squeeze the mercury out of it.
Wow.
That's so weird.
Yeah, so that is how they mine mercury, or how they used to anyway. Huh. Yeah.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you for listening to this, our third episode at long last.
Tune in next time to hear all about more Hittites and the Trojan War.
I'm so psyched about Hittites.
I'm so excited about that. I'm so excited.
Arissa, would you sign us off?
Thank you for listening to The Liberal Arts. Join us in a couple weeks to hear more, and until then, learn something worth knowing.